This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The fallout after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss fires his election investigator Michael Gableman. Why taxpayers will still be on the hook to pay mounting legal fees. Plus, Democrats have an edge over Republican candidates at the top of the ticket this fall. We discuss some of the key findings from the latest Marquette University Law School poll. And the Joint Finance Committee takes another crucial step towards building youth prisons across Wisconsin. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 19th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we're going to start the show kind of going back to last Friday, because this happens a lot. We tape the show, and then there's a news dump that happens on Friday. For our viewers that may not know, the big news on Friday afternoon is Assembly Speaker Robin Voss finally fired Michael Gableman, who was leading the GOP election review for the Assembly. We kind of knew something was coming because post-primary night, Voss called Gableman an embarrassment. And he kind of then further elaborated when he caught up with reporters a week after the primary on Tuesday, basically saying, this is the reason why our relationship turned sour. What that was is when Gableman presented his first interim report to the Assembly Elections Committee, he basically told them, hinted largely that, hey, here's a suggestion. There might be a pathway to decertification. You should take a hard look, was actually what he said. But it turns out he sent a memo to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss that said something completely different, that, you know, we're not going to go that route. So Voss basically, in this video that we're about to queue up, is kind of explaining, this is what happened. But, you know, this is months ago. So he led this review to keep going. So let's take a listen first from Robin.
You shouldn't be swayed based on who you talk to. Your opinion is your opinion. And I feel like at that point, it really became clear that he was looking for something else besides the truth. I think the original effort was still worthwhile. And I wish we could have stuck to that because it would have been able to prove whether or not there were serious problems with the election beyond what we already found.
So across the aisle, the firing of Michael Gableman had bipartisan praise. There were some Republicans, of course, Senator Kathy Bernier. She was always against what Gableman was doing. She didn't really think he was going to be finding anything revealing. He never found any evidence of widespread voter fraud. We have some statements up there. I'll just quickly go through them. Senator Kathy Bernier said it's about time in a statement. Assembly Minority Leader Greta Neubauer says, I'm relieved that this is closed, but she also said it's a little far too late. So we heard Voss say, well, I thought things kind of took a turn in March, yet he kept this going, JR, until after his primary. I think there was maybe a little bit of strategy there.
Oh, like also Adam Steen played a role in this. So go back to the spring. Gableman actually gave Robin a draft report before he presented to the Assembly Campaign's Elections Committee that didn't have the section on decertification. He gives a report in public, the section is there. So that's surprise number one for Robin Voss. Then he writes the memo to Robin saying, actually, no, we can't do this. So there's an issue. It wasn't, though, until Gableman began going, and Robin said that Gableman began going to political events. Well, he went to political events months before he was fired. The final straw probably was he went to a rally the Friday before the primary that Donald Trump had, and which was supposed to be about Tim Michaels, but became also an anti-Robin Voss rally. Adam Steen spoke there. Gableman backed Steen, recorded a robocall for Steen that went out before the primary that said that Robin Voss never wanted a real, quote-unquote, investigation of what happened in 2020, and all the fraud that Gableman claimed he found was in spite of Robin Voss, not because of him. That was probably it. Now, the question is, what took so long? He got through the primary. That might be part of it. Two, Gableman decided to go ahead and get very political and endorse not just anybody but his opponent. Rob made the point talking to us on Tuesday of Gableman was essentially Robin's attorney. How do you, as an attorney, go against your client? There seemed to be an ethical thing Robin brought up about that. Going forward, Gableman's no longer involved in these lawsuits that are going on about open record stuff. He wasn't there at least this week in one of them. He has retained his private counsel, apparently, and this stuff. So there's that. And we're all wondering, what's Gableman going to do next? So the point I think we brought up last week was, what's his strategy in all this? The only theories I've heard are that Michael Gableman believes that he could get a job with one of the Trump organizations, which are making a lot of money these days, getting donations. Or if Trump's elected to another term in 2024, he'd catch on with that. Because who in Wisconsin would hire Michael Gableman right now after all that he's done and this action?
Right. And also last week, we heard from a lot of Democrats that are kind of united on the front that they now want a full audit of Michael Gableman's office. Of course, Robin also says, Robin Voss, we're talking about, said, well, you know, I don't think that's necessary. You know, we have everything going on in the courts, which kind of leads us into our next topic with the American oversight versus the Office of Special Counsel. This has been going on for many months now. And what we learned is Dane County Judge Frank Remington issued his order after a court hearing on Tuesday, basically lifting a contempt order against Gableman, but still fined his Office of Special Counsel $24,000 for the 12 days he was in contempt of court. Now, this is, of course, one of four lawsuits related to open records. And basically, we kind of learned that Judge Remington was kind of hinting towards, you know, maybe this is it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to find anything else. There was these questions about a staffer and some other documents that were deleted. And Voss and Gableman both said, and their attorneys, we can't recover those. We've tried. There's nothing else we can do. So that was kind of maybe this could be the end of at least one of these court hearings. Let's just take a listen from a little bit of Judge Remington kind of explaining that a little bit more.
Everyone in this room is being paid for by the Wisconsin taxpayers. Your bills, your fee shifting, my salary, all of us are operating at the great expense to the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin. And here is what I'm told, that at point in time, it's undisputed, Mr. Gableman said he had in his employ, or he was associated with one unnamed, quote, confidential individual. The public records law certainly expects, and certainly the government ethics require, that if an office of special counsel, a subunit of the Wisconsin State Assembly, has a relationship with an individual, and especially if that individual is being compensated with taxpayer money, we ought to know who it is and whether, in fact, there was a contract or the like. This is yet one more example of a lot of questions that someone certainly should know the answer to, but perhaps not by anyone here in the courtroom this morning.
So while this probe is over, of course, these legal fees are going to continue to go up. We just heard another $24,000 from Judge Remington. And then I believe it was last week was another chunk of change. And Jerry, you and I have both been kind of keeping spreadsheets of this is way surpassed, I think, $1.1 million at this point.
So the most interesting thing was in the written decision that came out from Remington, I think the day after the hearing, was he basically said that the Office of Special Counsel accomplished nothing. Didn't really produce anything, and went out of his way to withdraw the permission of five out-of-state attorneys who were hired by the office to practice on the case. Now, Jim Bopp is an Indiana attorney. He was the lead counsel on this case. He basically said it was pointless and meaningless because the case itself is over before Remington. It is now on appeal, so he thought it was really kind of much about nothing. But Remington went out of his way to rip the counsel that Gableman had retained, saying that they were basically making stuff up in their court filings, had failed to follow the requirements of ethics to be a lawyer in Wisconsin, and had words for them. Now we go to appeal. On appeal, everything could go away. So the $24,000 in fines for being in contempt, that could go away. Legal fees could go away. So we're not sure that that's part of the actual price tag yet. But we are $1 million plus in mid-June. It's now August. We've had 260,000 roughly in attorney's fees awarded since then, plus the $24,000. So you can do some math, we're north of 1.3. Waiting for some more invoices from the assembly to see where we're at this point. But this is also only one of several lawsuits going on. There are also going to be appeals. That means the price tag will keep going up because of legal fees to fight these things. Now, Robin also spoke about two things during our little gaggle on Tuesday. There was Gableman's effort to jail the mayors of Madison and Green Bay and other local officials, as well as the fight that Josh Call put up in Dane County to say you can't interview Megan Wolf, the State Elections Commission Administrator, in private, must be in public. Robin said he will likely ask those to be basically dismissed because the thing is over. He wants to talk to attorneys first, but that would put those two things at rest. but keep the American Oversight lawsuits alive and on appeal for possibly quite a while.
Yeah, so in total, I believe there's 6 lawsuits mm-hmm. that are still ongoing, mm-hmm. even though the probe is over. So yep. we'll see what happens with those in the future. Staying on the topic of Robin Voss, basically his primary victory is being challenged by the man named Harry Waite, who openly admitted to committing voting fraud. He went into the MyVote system, requested absentee ballots for the Racine County mayor and Robin Voss. He did it maybe for other people. That's still unknown. But Waite is alleging that absentee ballots were not secure after he falsely requesting ballots on other voters' behalfs. And he claims the votes in that 64th Assembly District were skewed because of delays in the final election results. However, JR, those election results really weren't that delayed.
No.
So Waite, you got to take what he says mm-hmm. with a grain of salt. Also, a day after he blasted this victory or the wanting to challenge Voss's victory, we also learned from Adam Steen, who was Voss's opponent in the primary. Voss only beat by 260 votes. Steen is now launching a write-in campaign to basically write his name come November on the ballot.
Yeah. So let's start with this challenge. I'm not sure it's really a challenge. I don't know what else to call it, because he's saying there were problems. A problem, he says, that happened in the election, there were 303, I think it was, same registrations in the 63rd Assembly District. I have no idea why that's a problem, because in Wisconsin, we have same-day registration. It is perfectly legal. He says there were delays that suggest there are algorithms at play. Now, I went and talked to the county clerk this week. The timestamps on all 4 runs. So some counties do it differently, but Racine County had 4 runs of results, and they timestamp each of those runs and then post them on the website. The timestamps for all 4 runs concluded earlier than they did 2 years ago for the August primary. So if there was not a delay compared to 2 years ago. Compared to 4 years ago, it was like 5 minutes later. That's it for a couple of them, all right? There were 3 runs 4 years ago. No delay that we can see there. So these challenges, I'm not really sure it's a challenge. It was filed with several Racine County officials' offices. They forwarded it to the Elections Commission. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. I'm not expecting a whole lot. The canvas concluded. The 260 vote margin was confirmed by the canvas. It has to be certified by the state. You can file for a recount you can't, because Steen finished more than 1% behind Voss, but you can challenge after the canvas is certified by the state. Steen is a write-in candidate. Write-ins have to register with the state by the Friday before the election to actually count their votes, because you can run into anybody. They're not going to go to the trouble of counting all the write-ins. They'll have scattering. What I'm wondering is, well, the Democrats will have somebody to run as a write-in candidate. And then, two, will Democrats say, no, we're going to try and vote for Adam Steen to make Robin Voss's life difficult? I don't know if it would be successful. Those things are very, very difficult to do. It's just one more headache for Robin going forward. But the chances of a write-in campaign being successful are not very high.
Yeah, another thing, speaking of Voss, too, we asked him on Tuesday as well during that gaggle. He's still remaining speaker. Of course, they don't elect mm-hmm. who that might be or make changes on certain committees until about probably January or a little bit before that, Jer. But he also said as of now, State Representative Janelle Branchon is going to remain as the chair of the Assembly Elections Committee. But he kind of said her future is up in the air. So that's also something to watch for. She, of course, has been kind of a supporter mm-hmm. of Steen. That's why I'm bringing that up. And, of course, she applauded Harry Waite's efforts to kind of find irregularities in the MyVote system. Now we got to shift on to the latest Marquette University Law School poll results. Let's start with the governor's race, Jer. No big surprise here. It's being labeled as a toss-up. And, Michaels kind of narrowed his lead a little bit when there was head-to-head matchups with Evers against the Clayfish, Rantham, and Michaels. Evers is at 45%. Michaels is at 43%. That is within the margin of error. And then Joan Bellinger, she's an independent candidate. She's got 7%. And then 5% did not give any choice. So, like I mentioned, very early on, but I think it just, as Charles Franklin, poll director, said, it just shows it's going to be a tight race.
Yeah, a couple things to note. One, the independent Beglinger, 7%, I'll bet you a dollar she won't get 7% come November. In August of 18, I looked, a Libertarian candidate in the Gov's race was getting 6% in the Marquette poll. He got less than 1% come November. It's more a sign of people kind of not happy with either choice right now. Also, going back to 2002, when Ed Thompson got 10.4% of the vote as a Libertarian, no independent or third-party candidates cracked more than a point or two in a gov's race in Wisconsin. So I don't think she's going to get very far in terms of the vote total. It's more a sign, again, of people kind of like, I'm not sure right now who I want. Fox News had a poll come out Thursday night. It was 3 points in the gov's race without the independent listed. So it suggests that this is definitely a toss-up race.
And now moving on to the U.S. Senate race, I think this was the big headline that many people were writing about, is Mandela Barnes is up against Ron Johnson by 7 percentage points. 1% said neither, and 3% says they don't know. This is also very reflective of the Fox News poll that came out yesterday as well. The biggest thing here that I found interesting is the independent voters, which way they would sway, which candidate they would go to. Mandela Barnes is up 14% with independent voters compared to Johnson. And that's what also Charles Franklin was saying, is that's basically how he got this boost. Mm-hmm. And that's really going to matter. I mean, independent voters, of course, they're not partisan. They vote for both parties. They can make a difference in our elections. So I thought that was pretty interesting that he's doing so well. But we've talked about this on the show before. Ron Johnson just released his first negative ad against Mandela Barnes. Mandela Barnes hasn't really been shed in a bad light at all. Of course, there's right-wing, you know, news outlets that have been constantly keeping up on his record of what he says, et cetera, same as us. But he wasn't ever really challenged during the primary. None of his opponents went after him. So now you're going to see a lot more negative ads, as we know this race is going to get pretty nasty when it comes to the airwaves.
So the difference between the Gov's race and the Senate race, according to Franklin, was independents. Mm-hmm. So Barnes had that big lead, whereas Evers had a narrow one. This is both indicative of a bounce coming out of the primary. This poll went into the field the day after the primary, so amid a lot of coverage of both Barnes winning and Michaels winning, that probably helped. One thing about the Senate numbers, there are a number of Ron Johnson kind of fans or supporters who were quick to point out in August of 2016, Ron Johnson was also down in the Marquette Useful Law School poll and won that fall. Big difference, though. In August of 2016, Ron Johnson fired his creative staff, essentially, his advertising staff. He hit a low point of his campaign. He cleaned house with his operation and basically took over the message of his campaign and recovered from that. Also, in 2016, if you look at Ron Johnson's like favorable, unfavorable numbers, they were kind of trending back and forth between positive and negative, but with like they were 34, 32, 31, 35. They weren't like this. He is upside down again by double digits, with almost double digits, with voters. He is a much more known quantity, and people have been turned off by him. The door, though, that's open for him is to tear down Mandela Barnes. Of the people who were asked about how they view Barnes, like 40%, 41% didn't have an opinion of him. There is a huge avenue to define Mandela Barnes, and first ad from Ron Johnson this week is he's dangerously liberal. Has the squad, so-called squad from Congress up there showing that they want to defund police, and as we said was coming, the picture of Mandela holding the Abolish ICE t-shirt. We also saw Wisconsin Truth PAC, which is largely funded by Diane Hendricks and Elizabeth Uline, you know, two mega donors in Wisconsin politics. They went on the air with an ad, I think, last week. They haven't really been publicly advertising what they've been doing, but have been following buys with the FEC. That one knocks Barnes a number of fronts, including like forgiving college tuition debt, that kind of stuff. Student loan debt, sorry. So you're starting to see the effort to define Barnes as this radical, this kind of out of the mainstream person. The question is, will it work? And two, how does Johnson rehabilitate his image? Can he? Or is it just a race to who do you hate the least come November?
Right. And speaking of kind of reshaping his image, there was an NBC National article about just that Ron is trying to kind of change the tone because of he's had so many controversial headlines from COVID-19 treatments and his stance on abortion. So we also saw, I think it was a few weeks ago, I don't want to know exact date, Ron Johnson's campaign started airing, and I started seeing it too, more of a positive ad of his brother. It's a minute long of his brother talking about Ron's growing up, his work ethic, he built, you know, came from the bottom up, look at this. So it was kind of a different tone that I haven't seen before when it comes to labeling Ron Johnson. So that's definitely something that I found interesting. And we know there's going to be millions, tens of millions, I should say, being poured into this race when it comes to campaign ads. This is almost just the beginning. But we've mentioned before, this is going to get pretty nasty because who you hate the least. Yeah. And there's going to be, I mean, this is the most you know, closely watched Senate races across the country.
Also noteworthy, the NRSC this week pulled some ads out of three states, including Wisconsin. Now, they can be
shifted,
brought back in later on. The NRSC has got some fundraising issues. They insist it's not a big deal. It can come back in other forms. So it's not like it's going. It's not like 6 years ago where there was actually an effort by national Republicans to withdraw from the Wisconsin race and said, we're out of here. I mean, they said we might come back later on. We all figured they were abandoning Ron Johnson, which they basically did. There was one Wisconsin-based PAC that stuck with him through that helped him weather the storm. In the end, when people saw that, oh, this is actually a close race between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, you saw a flood of national Republican money come back in. It's part of why Ron Johnson doesn't really have any niceties for Mitch McConnell, because he won without Mitch 6 years ago. So he doesn't have any problem being at the form the side of Mitch McConnell leadership, because he feels like, hey, I won in spite of you guys, not because of you guys. So just watch that. Do they come back in? I'm assuming they're going to do something for him. The question is how much compared to what they were doing before. Like, do they, and they're not abandoning him, just not doing as much. Do they bring it back in? Yeah, we'll see.
And Johnson was also asked this week at a border security roundtable in Milwaukee, would he like to see President Trump come and stump from him here in Wisconsin? Ron Johnson did not mention his name, very kind of skirted the question, was very careful how he answered. So we'll see. I mean, maybe he's also kind of doing the Michaels dance of now trying, now that the primary's over, try to keep, you know, a Heisman pose away. But we'll see if that ever comes back. One other thing I want to highlight in the MU poll is top concern among voters. I always find this interesting. But still, inflation is number one, followed by gun violence, crime. Coronavirus, 20%. Kind of like to see it. It's still out there right now, but a lot fewer people are concerned. And then when you break it down by party, I believe it was Democrats said the top concern was climate change and gun violence. Then for Republicans was inflation and crime. So I also found that interesting, Jer. We haven't really heard too much climate change on the campaign trail, but if that's the number one concern of Democratic voters, maybe we see that shift in Mandela Barnes's campaign. Evers has talked about it frequently, but I haven't seen too much on the campaign trail, so we'll see with that. No surprise there are Republicans. They have been hammering inflation and the rise in violence and crime, excuse me, I should say, for a very long time, and I think they'll keep that messaging up. Another news this week is kind of another piece of the puzzle, JR, to the youth prison expansion here in Wisconsin. The Joint Finance Committee on this earlier this week approved $13.1 million for Milwaukee County on top of $15 million that has been previously allocated to secure a residential center. We followed up, you know, I think it was last week, we mentioned that they have found a location in Milwaukee to start, you know, moving, shifting, closing Lincoln Hills and having the youth come there. They also redirected about $21 million to secure a residential care centers that have been proposed in Dane and Brown counties to Milwaukee and Racine counties. Then we have also the $28 million that will be used to renovate and expand the Vell Phillips Youth and Family Justice Center in Wauwatosa, while Racine is moving ahead with around $50 million for the youth detention center. I think the caveat here is, JR, yes, we have some of these funds now, but is that going to be enough money, and when is this actually going to happen? It seems like not for a few more years.
So Evan Gwaeke is a Milwaukee Democrat who's been a big advocate for closing Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, talks about the three-legged stool. One leg is a new Type 1 facility, which we now have a site for at Milwaukee. That houses the most serious offenders in the youth system. The second leg is expanding Mendota, which is here in Dane County. That is basically geared toward treating those who have mental health issues. Every female in the state system up at Copper Lake has a mental health issue. They will all eventually go to Mendota, which is in the process of being expanded as we speak. The third leg is the county-run facilities. Now, way back when, they signed this bill in 2018 to do everything. It's $80 million total to build two Type 1 facilities in Wisconsin and four or five county-run facilities. That is nowhere near what was needed to do this process. So now we have a $42 million Type 1 facility in Milwaukee County that is moving forward. The county-run facilities, which this vote was about here, so Dane and Brown counties kind of went, we're not going to go through with this in the end. Racine is the farthest ahead. It asked for more money, in part because of inflation, saying that the COVID supply chain and everything else has driven up the cost of this project to $50 million. We need more state funds. That's part of what's happening there. Milwaukee expanded its project and has inflation pressures. That's what's happening there with the $28 million for their facility. Now, the other thing is, with that Type 1 facility is $42 million. That's not going to be the final price tag, I will bet you. Again, on the dollar. DOA, Department of Administration, sent a memo to finance on Friday of last week laying out the process for this new facility to open. Remember, Lincoln Hills is supposed to close January 1 of 2021.
Yes.
Evers and lawmakers pushed it back to July 1st of 2020, I think it was, of 2021. Mm-hmm. That's well beyond where we're at. The bids for the new Type 1 facility won't go out until 2024. Construction will start after that, 18 to 24 months to complete the facility substantially. Another 90 days for true completion, which is furnished, everything works, like all nuts and bolts are in place. Do your math, at a minimum, it's going to be mid-2026 before this thing opens, 5 years after Lincoln Hills was supposed to close originally. It's $42 million right now for this facility. DOA sent a memo to state agencies back in May because we have a new budget coming up. They're already working on the one that's going to be introduced early next year. There's a capital budget, and DOA told agencies, you should assume for your cost projections inflation of 8% every 6 months through 2023, 4% every 6 months through 2024. Do some basic math. It's not going to start until 2024. We put aside $42 million now. How is that going to cover that inflationary cost for the new Lincoln Hills, essentially? Mary Felskowski, whose district includes the current youth prisons, said it's going to cost more. Just looking at that, you can figure it out. So we may have to come back and revisit this issue later on. What I'm getting at, the timeline is going to be slow to replace this. You're probably going to see kids move into Mendota first before you see them move over to the new Type 1 facility in Milwaukee sometime in 2026.
Jared, I guess we did see some bipartisanship when this second, I guess, round of let's start making more money available. I believe that was, it was November, I want to say. The legislature was one of the final days of the assembly. They passed another bill to get this ball rolling, to allocate more funds. That was bipartisan. It was bipartisan back in 2018. Do we see this becoming political on the campaign season at all? Or is it kind of, you know, a done deal, even though we haven't seen the final product?
There were Republicans I talked to when they signed off and doing the Type 1 saying, hey, this is now Evers' problem because he has to find a site in Milwaukee County, and that's part of his base. If he picks the wrong site, he's going to be in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. So let's get this thing done and push it through. If you look at the release that came out last week about the new Type 1, Lena Taylor praised the site selection. Lena was one of the biggest critics of the discussion of converting an existing facility for adults, a work release program facility, into a youth prison, saying that's not going to work. You're going to hurt people doing that. The fact they found this other site, and look, nobody wants a youth prison in their backyard, all right? You're always going to have mixed reaction people who are near the facility. But you see almost universal praise from groups in Milwaukee of the site selected because it preserves that work release program. So that seems to be one issue off the table. Also, going back to Goyke with this, you know, construction of the prison and the timeline, he said you can't cut corners on this facility. So yes, it's going to cost more in the end, but you don't want to do things the wrong way or try and scrimp, because we have had such an issue housing youthful offenders in Wisconsin and their treatment, and also the danger to guards, who numerous ones have been injured.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The thing about the timeline that Felskowski pointed out was this prison up in northern Wisconsin is supposed to be converted to a medium security adult facility that, well, I think it's going to do drug and alcohol cases a lot. The guards who work at Lincoln Hills Copper Lake right now are, in her words, holding on because the conditions are so bad up there. They're not exactly enjoying going to work, that because those are good jobs, and they know that's going to be converted eventually into a new facility that they can have a different experience at. But that's also an issue because we have a huge issue staffing prisons in Wisconsin. Upon the highest maximum security prisons in Wisconsin, perpetually having issues filling guard slots. So there's an issue to watch up there, too, that complicates this thing again of the longer it takes to build the new Type 1, the more you risk losing people to staff the eventual adult facility up there for that purpose.
Right, exactly. All right, well, we'll see. We'll count how many years, I guess. We'll celebrate it then. All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.